This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On November 24, 1859, just about exactly 150 years ago, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species. At the time, his ideas really rocked the world. You know the basic theory. Over the course of many, many generations, all living creatures evolve and adapt physically and mentally by means of chance mutations. And he or she who reproduces the most wins. With such truly radical ideas, it helped that Charles Darwin was one of the most terrific science writers ever. Long before he published The Theory of Evolution, he'd become famous for the journal that he kept during the voyage of the Beagle.
When the condors are wheeling in a flock, round and round any spot, their flight is beautiful. I watched several for nearly half an hour without once taking off my eyes. They moved in large curves, sweeping in circles, descending and ascending without giving a single flap.
So on the one hand, he was trying to write very, very accurately, get exactly the colour of each sort of specimen he was looking at, and on the other hand, he was trying to write vividly and to express and convey his own enthusiasm for what he was seeing and thinking.
Ruth Padell is a poet and a professor of poetry at Oxford, and she is also Charles Darwin's great-great-granddaughter. This year, she published a biography of her famous ancestor, all in verse. It's called Darwin, A Life in Poems. So as you were growing up and in your family, is being a descendant of Charles Darwin a big deal?
When I look back, it was just a fact, you know. It wasn't a big deal. I didn't know who he was, really. I mean, I knew Dr. Doolittle. Do you have Dr. Doolittle?
Yes, we do.
Yeah, I used to love those books. And, you know, my grandmother, she was the person who really started Darwin scholarship. She edited his the journals he kept on the Beagle.
This is Nora Barlow.
That's right, yes. Uh-huh. And Charles Darwin was kind of part of the house that I loved, the big garden, the dogs, the flowers, the rooms, the books.
So as a young girl, you got this child's cozy, lovely sense of Darwin. And when you think about it, what he did was, compared to what most respectable gentlemen did, a kind of child's pursuit.
That's right. He had this sense of wonder. I mean, Darwin and Emma, Charles Darwin and Emma, his wife, they, you know, the children ran in and out. He would string them out across the meadow and get them to, you know, to join in his experiments, like trying to paint the bumblebees with little bits of white sort of flowery liquid. And he was always looking at all life forms, you know, whether they were ants or children or bees, and thinking, how does it feel to be like that? I wonder if...
In addition to being like something a child would imagine, it also seems like something that would derive from the soul of an artist, imagining ways in which the world could be connected that are not conventional.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And I responded to that very much when I was working on these poems. Mm-hmm. When he was on the Beagle, the one book he took in his pocket always for land expeditions was Milton's Paradise Lost. He loved Wordsworth. You know, one of his favorite lines of Wordsworth was, "Nature never will betray the heart that loves her." But as he got older, he felt rather sad at the end of his life that he said, if I'd had my life over again, I would have made it a rule to read a poem every day.
Well, there you go. Now, well, I guess that somehow made its way into you. You write a poem that, indeed, I found very moving, called Plankton, and I'd love it if you could read that for us.
Sure. No, I'm glad you like that one. It's when he's just getting his sea legs in December 1831. And here he is in January 1832, and he's been terribly sick, seasick. He's been lying on the floor moaning. And suddenly the sea calms. They're in the North Atlantic, and he's really discovering, naturalising with properly equipped things for the first time. And he is entranced. Plankton. The deck is dazzle. Fish stink. Gauze-covered buckets. Gelatinous ingots. Rainbows of wet flinching amethyst and flubbed iridescent cream. All this means he's better and working on a hall of lumpen light. Polyps, plankton, jellyfish. Sea butterflies, the pteropods. So low in the scale of nature, so exquisite in their forms. You wonder at so much beauty created apparently for such little purpose. they lower his creel to blue paws of subtropical ocean. Wave flicker, white as a gun flash, over the blown heart of sapphire. Peacock eyes, beaten and swollen, tossing on lazuline steel.
Ruth Bedell reading Plankton from her book Darwin, A Life in Poems. When did you first decide you wanted to write a poem about Charles Darwin?
Well, it came in different stages. I remember once looking after my grandmother, Nora, towards the end of her life in Cambridge. It was a very rainy summer, and she was talking to me about Charles and Emma's relationship, which had to negotiate this increasing gulf in their religious attitudes.
On the basis of what Charles was discovering and what she could not accommodate.
Yes, she knew his ideas. He discussed them with her. But in the 19th century, there was so much death around that Christianity was very, very much based on the afterlife. And, you know, it was felt at this time, and Emma shared this view, that if you didn't believe in Christian revelation, you would go to hell. And so if there was a husband and wife and one of them believed and one of them didn't, they wouldn't be together in eternity. And I thought, my goodness, I'd like to write about that.
Do you think Darwin's ideas get sort of misused in public currency?
I think they do. I hope that this year has done a lot to dispel some of the myths. When he was working, when he saw as a young man, not quite 30, that natural selection would be the mechanism for the ways species had evolved, he kept it to himself because he knew that it would be anathema unless he could prove it. And the thing that was radical was the idea that a living species changed. It was a great breakthrough, but he didn't actually tell it to even his closest friend, John Hooker, the botanist at Kew Gardens, until 1844. And then he just said, it's very revolutionary. It is like confessing to a murder, he said.
I presume you, rather than simply relying on family lore, spent a lot of time reading Darwin's letters and notes and papers as you were preparing to write these works. Was there a single sort of surprise about Charles Darwin that you came across?
I think it was the humor, the humor and the warmth. And once you're with him, you just sort of want to smile at what he's saying. But then there was also the emotional passages. Where the great, great loss of his life, aside from his mother when he was 8, was their 10-year-old daughter, Annie, when she was 10. And the other thing I ought to perhaps explain is that the more he worked, the more he did experiments, the more he realized about breeding, that sexual selection was so crucial because there were two different parents, not from the same stock, but he had married his own first cousin. So maybe he was responsible for Annie's death. That was the iron in his soul after she died.
Really? I never knew that. He wondered that he had not sufficiently hybridized.
Yes. He was terrified of that, and he was terrified of the other children. He was always looking out for illness in the other children. He felt it was his fault.
Do you have a favorite poem from the book?
I have favourite passages of poems. I really am very fond of Emma's letter that she writes to him after he has told her about his religious doubts. But it's quite a long one.
Could you read some of it?
I'll read some of it, yeah.
Great.
It's called A Path Around a Lake. It's from December 1838. She's thinking about what he said. It is foolish, perhaps, but now we belong, my own dear Charlie, to each other. I cannot help being open with you. Melancholy thoughts keep generally out of my head, but since you are gone, some sad ones have forced themselves in. I know we feel the same about right and wrong, but our opinions on the most important thing are very different. Your faith should stand in the power of God, not the wisdom of man. My reason says honest, conscientious doubt cannot be a sin, but it would be a painful void. Religion is an affair of the heart, not the intellect. This is a whim of mine. If you would read Our Saviour's Farewell to His Disciples, the part of the New Testament I love best. She looks at the sandy path where they used to run as children round the lake. You'll read the thing, never doubt it. Then, though I can hardly tell why, I don't wish you to give me your opinion about it.
That's Ruth Bedell reading part of A Path Around a Lake from her book Darwin, A Life in Poems.